Here we go. The first question is, does everyone have not so good meditation? Even people who have attained jhanas and arahats. Everyone has good meditation except you. No. It depends upon causes and conditions. So this is a common story. I told this to someone earlier. Even if you get a good meditation, don't think the next one will also be good, and the one after also good. Once there was a man in Singapore, he'd come in from Indonesia, and he was working on a building site. Monday he worked very hard, the same as Tuesday and Wednesday. For 3 days he worked really hard, and he didn't get paid. So when he went home on a Wednesday, he told his wife, "It's a waste of time working in Singapore. They don't pay you any money." But his wife said, "No, you go to work on Thursday as well." So he went to work on Thursday, he came back, said, "See, they still don't pay you." And he wasn't doing anything on Friday, so he went back there on Friday. On Friday, the boss paid him. So when he went home on Friday night, he told his wife, "I understand how it's done in Singapore now. From here on in, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays." Of course, you're paid on Friday because of all the work you've done Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So when you have a nice meditation, it's payday. You don't expect to be paid again the next meditation. You've got to do some work, okay? And then when you build up your credit, then you get payday. So that's what you're doing. You're building up the credit of peace, letting go. And when you've got enough contentment, peace, letting go, kindness, when that's big enough, then you get another nice meditation. That is how it works. And if you stay here, you get bonus as well. Dear Ajahn, please tell us another ghost story. Okay, you can't, where's Utah? Okay, lights please. No coughing jokes, no, okay. Another famous one. How many of you remember the story of the ghost in the elevator?
Yep.
How many haven't heard it? Say yes. Okay, this is one of the scariest real ghost stories ever. So be careful. Those of you who get so scared you can't sleep at night, please leave now. This was a true story which I heard many years ago, which happened in Sirirat Hospital in Bangkok, which was the main hospital just across the river from, you know, the Wat Mahathat, the old palace, you know, the Sanam Luang, the central field in Bangkok. Just across from there is this huge hospital called Sirirat Hospital, the main hospital in the center of Bangkok. Early one morning, the doctor was finishing his shift. He was in the elevator and there was a nurse there as his witness, because going down, the elevator stopped halfway down to the basement where he was going to get into his car and drive home after working all night. Already one person is leaving. You see, it's a very scary... Another one is going as well. They're locking the doors now so no one else can get out. And the elevator stopped halfway to the basement. And when the doors of the elevator opened, there was a patient standing on the other side. There's another one's going. Everyone would be gone by the time I did this. And there's a patient on the other side of the elevator. As soon as the doctor saw that patient, all the colour drained from his face and his lips started to quiver. He was shocked and he... Another one gone. It's a nice story. You nabby-pabby cream puffs. And he pushed the button on the elevator to close the doors as quickly as possible, pushing it to try and get those doors to close. He succeeded. The doors closed before the patient could get in. And the nurse was so disgusted with the doctor's behavior. That was a patient who wanted to get in the elevator. Why don't you let him get in? And the doctor said, that was my patient. He died last night. I confirmed him dead. That's not a patient, that's a ghost. And he said, didn't you see the red string on his wrist? Because in Thailand, you know these white strings we put on people's wrists? In Thailand, it's a custom, once you're dead, they put red string on the wrist. That signifies that that's a dead person. And the doctor said, he had red string on his wrist, he's a ghost! And that's when the nurse said, oh, I've got a red string too. Does that mean I'm not allowed in the elevator? And that was a true story, as told by the doctor, once they resuscitated him. Because they found him, true story, they found him collapsed on the lift floor, elevator floor, and they didn't know why. And when they revived him, that's the story he told. And they checked out that nurse. She was actually dead. She died in a road accident on the way to work that morning. So imagine that. A ghost outside the elevator and one inside as well. That's scary. Okay, you can turn the lights on now and invite the other people in again. Ghost stories over. So, you Tom, can you write them in if they haven't sort of run away now? You tell them there's more ghosts outside than inside. You better come. These are crazy people. Yeah. They're coming in. They'll probably run away forever now. Sorry? No more registrations now. Of course there'll be more registrations. You always like getting scared. That's why you always ask for ghost stories. Okay, thank you for coming again. Ghost stories over now. All finished. Very good. Very good. You're fine now. It had a happy ending. Sort of. Dearest Ajahn, the book, The Art of Disappearing, you mentioned, Try Not to Gaze into Space. But my mind, I kept going there, then resting, seemingly feeling peaceful. The breath became very light, like fading away. Is it being lazy? Each time I bring my attention back to the breath, it feels like going back to start point. Why? Thank you blissfully. I don't know what I wrote in The Art of Disappearing. I can't remember. Try not to gaze into space. What did I say there? I don't know. But anyway, if it works, do it. So, you mentioned you were... The mind kept going into space and resting, seeming peaceful. The breath became very light, like fading away. Is it being lazy? No, if your breath became very light and it felt like it was fading away, and you got lots of awareness and you got happiness as well, well done. That's what you're supposed to do. So I don't know what I said. That's a trouble. I say so much. And I say so many books, and it's bound to contradict yourself sooner or later. But anyway, if it works, fine. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the nice, big, comfortable room bed that I had slept very comfortably in until last night. Couldn't stop thinking about Thai curry and hunger. Couldn't sleep because fear of ghosts. Humbly request, please kindly don't talk about ghosts and... and... ghosts and curry at night. Okay, well, I promise not to talk about any more ghosts or curry. No ghosts, no curry. I'm not going to talk about food. I'm not going to... Never mind, you can catch up on sleep later on. When my hands start disappearing, I usually feel an obvious increase in body temperature. Why is this, please? Also, my eyelids flutter when lights come on during the delightful breath. Why is this happening? Is it a projection of image by will? Yeah, the eyelids fluttering, that's sometimes because you feel you're seeing an imitator. If you don't, the eye doesn't know what to do. So if that happens a lot, your eyelids flutter, go and get one of the eye shades. I've got a couple in my bag. If you want one, I can get one for you. So you can put it over your eyes when you're meditating. It's very comfortable. And then your eyes don't flutter. So when you see a nimitta also, you're absolutely sure this is the nimitta. It can't be a light because you've got the shades on. So that's a very easy way to overcome that. When your hands start disappearing, you start getting peaceful. You get an obvious increase in body temperature. There's a couple of reasons why that is. The most likely reason, it's always a very good reason, because when you get out of the way, relax and rest, the body starts to heal itself. And sometimes that's why you get this energy coming into your body, making sure everything which needs some extra energy gets it. And if it's a general problem with your body, yeah, your whole body will get a bit warm. It's just healing. I know this because there's many people, the classic story, teaching a retreat, and then one lady came up to me, you know, like, instead of answering the question in public, she did in an interview, she said, oh, my shoulders were really warm during the meditation, and there's really, really a lot of energy and heat there, what's going on? And I said, when did you have your whiplash accident? Hey, I never told you that. Psychic powers, you can read minds, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And it's not psychic powers. It's because I know that, you know, this is healing going on. And healing in your shoulders and neck, what's the most common, even I know that, no, doctors will know that, most common cause of that is road accidents and whiplash. So I just added one and one and got two and got the correct answer. So that's healing going on. You've had a car accident, something's gone wrong with your body, and now when you get out of the way, when you're getting into deep meditation, the body just pushes all energy up there to give you healing. And I remember she said, yeah, that's right, it feels so good, it hasn't felt so relaxed in a long time. And that's what happens. It's just usually healing. So if you get hot spots in the body, or warmth all over the body, especially during the peaceful times of meditation, that's excellent. You'll probably feel much more relaxed and healthy afterwards. How does one in a lot of physical pain on a sick bed meditate? We're near death, how do you meditate? What advice would you give to someone near death? First of all, we're all near death. There is about 70 people in this room, some people from Bodhinyana. According to statistics, yeah, at least one of us, according to statistics, will be dead this time next year. Which one is it? And don't just look at the old ones. We all die sooner or later. So first of all, how does one in a lot of physical pain on sick bed meditate? It's very much the case if there's something you can do about it, do it. So if you can take morphine, take the morphine. It's not a problem. Because just before you die, you get clear of the morphine. Basically, your mind separates from the brain. The morphine just dulls all the pain out, and so you do get into a dull, low state of mindfulness those last few days before you actually die. But just before you die, you get clear. And the first time I read this was in a short story by Tolstoy. It was really well known before they had painkillers that people just before they died, all the pain vanished. And they were clear. And it was a story of, you know, in some country house in Russia where one of the elderly people there was so sick and there was no possibility of trying to alleviate the pain. They were moaning and screaming all day and night, 24 hours. And describing in this story how it was driving everybody crazy. Now you're in a house and one person that you love is just moaning and groaning continuously. Now, without any sleep, 24 hours, and they were trying all sorts of medication and stuff, and nothing worked. And then they said, suddenly, just the moaning and groaning stopped. And he hadn't died yet. Had 5 or 10 minutes, and it was totally clear and pain-free, and then they died. And it's, you know, it's a common thing which happens. Many people have had that. I remember a couple of girls who come to Perth, they said they were either side of their father's bedside as he was dying, you know, and they don't know when that last moment is. So they're holding his hand, you know, he's struggling to breathe, he'd been in a coma for a couple of days. And then, without any warning, he sort of opened his eyes, and he was on his back, he leant up, sat up, and he looked at his two daughters, and they said, without any planning, now almost with synchronicity, "We love you, Dad." And then he fell back and died. And it's just like the last, you know, minute was absolutely clear, you know, conscious. And that's actually not uncommon. Have you seen that, Priya? People conscious at the last moment of death? Have you been with many people die? Oh, you haven't. It's really common. And there's many examples of that. So what it actually means, and that's how we understand the mind works. The last moments are clear of the morphine. So that's why if you are sick, if you are dying, please take the morphine. So you can die peacefully out of compassion for yourself. It's quite unpleasant otherwise and very difficult for everybody. And don't think, oh, that means I'm not going to be mindful at my end. You'll find that the last minute or 5 minutes, or the record I heard was about 15 minutes. Totally clear. And that was that man with a brain tumour. It was written in, of all things, Time magazine, but it was written by a doctor in some hospital in the United States. His patient, this guy, had a brain tumour. It was, you know, inoperable, and it was taking over, colonizing all the sort of the other cells in the brain. And you could actually see its progress. And the doctor said, this is exactly what's going to happen. Soon you'll lose many of your functions, not being able to speak properly, not being able to move your limbs. You know, your memory will go, and then your consciousness, you won't be able to talk. And the last part of the brain will be just for, you know, your basic bodily functions of, you know, the heart and the lungs and the other organs. And then eventually there won't be any brain left to be able to keep those going, and you will die. It's just a tumour colonising the brain. And you can actually almost predict when that would happen. So when the doctor said, you know, it'll probably be today that the last part of the brain will be taken over. So all the family were there. And the family around the bedside, and the doctor couldn't believe it. He'd been again in a coma for 3 or 4 days. He opened his eyes. Again, he sat up. And he talked to his family for 15 minutes, telling them, you know, the last request, how much he loved them all. And at this time, his brain was just totally taken over with the tumour. Hardly anything left, even for basic bodily functions. And his memory was intact, and he could talk, he could move his lips, which was, the doctor said, it was impossible. But he saw it. That's actually what happens at the end. Your mind takes over and does these things. The brain is shot. Because of that, take the morphine. And when near death, how do you meditate? If it's other times, just the best thing is just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just let go, let go, let go. There's one of our disciples here. She was actually going back from here. And you know, she must have been very tired because she fell asleep at the wheel. And went over into the soft shoulder, and the car rolled 3 times. And as she was rolling, she soon woke up, and she said, "Let go, let go, let go." And then she looked and she was upside down, but she was perfectly okay. And she was so proud of herself. "Yes, I remembered. I'm a good Buddhist. I said, let go, let go, let go at the end," because she thought she was dying. So that was a good sort of rehearsal. She passed the test. Tick, well done. And that's what you can do. So that's the best thing, what happens when you someone near death. Tell them just to let go. And also remember to give people who are dying permission to die. Somebody else told me, I think it was in Malaysia, they told me that story recently, because I was there last week, or just over a week ago. They said that they'd heard this from me before, and the patient there was really struggling, and then they took the family aside. Is that you, Peter, who said that? Yeah. Sorry?
That's Pochen.
Pochen, okay. Or somebody. No, I think it wasn't Pochen, it was somebody else. But anyway, they took the patient aside. They took the family aside, and they said, oh no, that was not Pochen, that was what the little girl, the social worker over in KL.
Barbara
told me that. And Barbara said that she took the family aside, said, this is something very difficult I'm going to tell you, but you have to give your loved one permission to die, because you're keeping them here. And so they understood that, they went to see their father, they told him, look, no, we all give you permission to die. An hour later he died. It's so common. The reason they're in that deathbed struggling is because they love all their relations standing around. And the last thing we want to do, you know, for the people who love us so much, who we spent so much time with, is to hurt them by dying. So if you give your loved ones permission to die, I mean literally say, it's okay, we give you permission to die, we're okay, please just go. Then they go. It's amazing just how that was the one thing keeping them alive and making them suffer. And so that's the same for you. Give yourself permission to go. I'll give you permission to go anytime, except on this retreat, because that would be a lot of problem for me, looking after all, taking the coffin over to Singapore and stuff. So please, you can die, but not on the retreat. Dear Ajahn, why were there no precepts taken ceremony at the start of this retreat? How do we tell the other retreatants if they are not observing the precepts? We are supposed to keep noble silence, thank you. Okay, the reason I don't give the 8 precepts is because it's assumed, it's obvious, that's what you do when you get here. There's no food in the afternoon. So, you're expected to keep, you know, the 8 precepts. Not deliberately killing any living beings, not taking what's not given, not stealing, no sexuality, no going into each other's rooms during this retreat. You're good people, you don't do that sort of stuff, you know, no lying. No taking alcohol or non-medicinal drugs. So I don't expect you to have parties in your room and get the whiskey out and just have a good time. It's not a good time, actually, it's a bad time. So, you know, no alcohol. And it's okay to take medicinal drugs. If someone has given you, say, insulin because you've got diabetes, please take it. Don't think, oh my goodness, I'm not supposed to take any drugs whatsoever. So please take the medicinal drugs, and then, you know, we don't eat in the afternoon, that's obvious here, and we don't, what else don't we do? No makeup, or jewelry, or singing and dancing. I haven't heard any singing and dancing yet, so you're keeping that precept. No entertainment, the only entertainment is coming to listen to my silly jokes. And, sorry? Yeah, it's luxurious beds. So the beds you've got, we looked at those, they are not luxurious. They're comfortable, but not luxurious. And no high seats like thrones. But I tell people, look at me, high and luxurious seats, especially high seats. I break that every time I go to Malaysia and Singapore. Because when I go to Malaysia and Singapore, my seat is about 36,000 feet above the ground. That is a high seat. That's not what it means. It means luxurious, where you, you know, it's where you feel proud of this, you know, your throne you're sitting on. So that's, you know, there are precepts. So I'm sure you can all keep those. And you know, there are sometimes some people who have stomach problems, severe stomach problems, or they have to take some antibiotics in the evening. You all should know by now, if that's the case with you, then just, you know, tell me or tell Daniel, and then you can get something, you know, very simple in the evening, just to make sure your stomach doesn't get too sick. So that's okay, that's allowable, but you don't have a full meal. You know, the whole spread on the table, because I've got to take this little pill. Otherwise, you'll all go to the doctor and say, prescribe me something, prescribe me something. So that is fine, it's just compassion. So we keep it as simple as possible. So maybe I should have mentioned that the first night, but even if I did, you wouldn't have heard it, because the PA system was playing up. Durajan, if you count during walking meditation, is that not focusing on the present moment? You can count, if you like, when you're doing walking meditation, one, two, three, or whatever. But be careful, because after a while it just gets too burdensome, counting all the time. So it's okay to do that at the very beginning, even counting your breaths. Okay, this is going to make many of you something to do. The way I did counting of breaths for a while, breathing in 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, in 3, out 3, in 4, out 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7, in 8, out 8, in 9, out 9. I stopped at 9. And then I started again, in 1, out 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, in 6, out 6, in 7, out 7, in 8, out 8. Just up to 8 this time. Then in 1, out 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, in 7, out 7, and then 1 less, up to 6, up to 5, up to 4, in 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, in 3, out 3, and then in 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, and lastly in 1, out 1. That was my whole cycle. And it shows you how interested you are, because you can get your head around that, that's something you can do. But that was actually, was it? That was, I think, 45 breaths. And what happened sometimes when I tried that, because they wasn't mindful, you're too sleepy, I found myself saying, in 15, out 15, in 16, I forgot to stop. Or sometimes I wasn't quite clear which, you know, where I was in the 1 to 6 or the 1 to 4. And if there was any doubt, I had to start right at the very beginning again, until I could complete about 3 cycles. And then I realized, yes, I was mindful enough and aware enough just to let the counting go and just watch the breath. So you can try that if you like. It just makes it a little bit interesting, a bit of a challenge, watching the breath by doing a counting. But don't do it too long. Otherwise you get people with their calculators. 1, 2, and it gets too much. So keep it simple. So you can count, and it does help you come into the present rather than stop all the thinking. I find it hard to forgive some people, even though intellectually it doesn't make sense, as not forgiving has been described as hoping for a better past. How is my not being able to forgive others related to the need to forgive myself? Is it because I am not forgiving to that other that I am not able to forgive myself? You should forgive to yourself first of all, then you can forgive others. You're not such a bad person. When you forgive, first of all, you have to find the reason to forgive. And the reason to forgive is realizing that you are not such a bad person, and neither are they. For those of you who've read your book, Good, Bad, Who Knows, you have there the story of the piece of paper. If you've read that already, the piece of paper, I read this somewhere a long time ago. It was at a funeral of a Western man somewhere, and at funerals in the West, it's so common now for the relations and loved ones to stand up and say something about the person who's died. It's called eulogies, which mean actually literally mean good words. So when the widow was given a eulogy about her husband, she got out half a piece of paper, you know, torn down the middle, and she said, "My husband kept this in his wallet throughout his whole life. He had it before I met him. He said this helped him forgive others and forgive himself." And the story behind this piece of paper was when he was still at school as a young boy in an all-boys class. There was about to be a fight. You know, boys, too much testosterone, you know, in the teenage years. And the teacher ordered them to all sit down, get out a sheet of paper from their exercise book, draw a vertical line through the middle of that sheet of paper. On the top, put down the name of the boy they hated the most in that class, their number one enemy. And then on the left-hand side of that line, write down all the reasons why they hated that boy's guts. Which they all did. It was very easy to do and actually enjoyed doing that. And on the other side of the line, the right-hand side, fill that part of the paper up with all the wonderful, good, kind qualities that you admire in that boy. And that took a lot longer, but they had to do that. Now once they finished up the right-hand side, the teacher asked them to fold it down the middle and tear it very carefully in two. And she came around with the trash can, the waste basket. The left-hand side, with all the things you hate about that boy, put in the trash can. The right-hand side, with all the qualities you admire in your enemy, get up and go and give it to them. He said, this was a half piece of paper which my husband's enemy, the person who wrote his name on the top, they hated my husband the most. And these are all the good qualities my husband's enemy saw in him. And every time he wanted to get angry, was upset at somebody, he'd get out these things and say, my enemy could see these things in me. Why can't I see those things in the person who hurt me? He said that made him forgive and not get angry at anyone. Beautiful little story. So if you're angry at somebody, then piece of paper, line down the middle, all the things you hate about them on the left side, all the things you like about them on the right-hand side, and don't write in really big letters on the right-hand side and small letters on the left-hand side. Keep it equal, even, sama-sama. And that way, when you tear it down, all the rotten things, throw that away, that's rubbish stuff. And keep the other part. All the things you admire in your ex-partner, in your boss who sacked you, in the person who hurt you. You can do that, and that means you can see a reason to forgive and let go in that person. They're not all bad. So that's a good way of dealing with it. Very practical, and it works. Dear Bhante, do you spend 6 months in solitude every year? If only. I have to work so hard, going to Singapore and Malaysia and Melbourne and all sorts of, where else here? So many places, and sometimes even Oslo, Helen. They try and get me there as much as possible. So I do actually travel a lot, so it's very hard to get 6 months of solitude. I always get 15 days of solitude every year. That's during our range retreat. I always make sure I take a retreat for 15 days. But when in solitude, do you stay in your kuti and gehewa all the time? Do you go out for a walk? And when I do my 15 days, I don't go out for a walk anywhere. Just walk on a walking meditation path outside. So I just stay in that area, don't go anywhere. No need to. Everything you ever need in life is there when you're content. Why go anywhere? When you're happy wherever you are. Dear your roundness, thank you. So if I get any fatter, you can actually call me the next one. Dear your very roundness. And then later on in life, you become your extreme roundness. And last of all, your ultimate roundness. I would like to share with all that I saw a 1 foot long, about 2 inch diameter, reptile-like animal, with tiny feet, slowly crawling along cottage doors. So please be careful when you open your cottage doors, thank you. That is a bobtail lizard. Now, the kids at school pick them up. They're totally safe. If you scare them though, they'll raise their head, open their mouth, and stick their tongue out at you. That's what they do to try and scare you, but they can't harm you at all. And there's one of the ladies, she's got about 8 or 9 of them in her house. And they recognize her and they lick her and do all sorts of stuff. They're really quite tame. So that's a bobtail lizard. No problem at all. Now, even the kids in Australia just pick them up and just, and when they see, you know what boys are like in schools, they've got to go, because it opens its mouth. It's got a blue tongue. To the person who sits right at the back, it was most likely the raw onion and not the cheese. Now what is it? Did you know that one? About passing wind. It's okay to pass wind, it's just four elements, that's all. It's just faint, it's just nice smell, rotten smell. You know that smells, you know, what some people like, other people find offensive. You know, you take a fly and think, oh, you're so fragrant today. You know that I haven't seen it in the grounds, but one day I visited our centre in Perth, in Nollamara, and there was this terrible smell of dog shit there. And I thought that somebody must have trodden in some dog poo. So straight away I looked at all the shoes and smelt them. There's nothing on the shoes. There's a very strong smell, you know, in the reception area. So like most people, you know, you smell it and see how it gets stronger and stronger to find its source. And I couldn't believe its source was a flower. This beautiful yellow flower. And somebody who had hay fever, had a blocked nose, had picked this thinking how beautiful it is, not being able to smell it. And put it in the vase, about to present it to the Buddha. And it really smelled exactly like dog poo. And the reason is because that particular flower they only have in Australia is pollinated by flies. It attracts the flies because it smells like dog poo. They go in it and they get the pollen and then they go to another flower which smells the same. And that's how it's pollinated, not by bees, but by flies. So it's been developed, you know, evolved over centuries to smell like dog poo. The most amazing flower. So see, even though it smells, some people like it. So even if you fart, there's somebody who likes it. So that's all these things about the food. The food you don't like, there's someone else likes it. And the food that, you know, you like, other people don't like. That's just the nature of things. Anyway, dear Ajahn, after a horrendous day yesterday, I think I might have had a wobbly limiter today. You see, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, but yesterday was the day you got work, you worked and didn't get paid. So you know the paycheck's in the mail, it'll come eventually. I think I might have had a wobbly limiter today from a very peaceful state. I was suddenly pulled into this amazingly peaceful tunnel upwards, and this pulsating white light like an eye appeared and kept growing and growing while pulsating. During all that time my eyelids kept fluttering and my heart racing. And also I said, calm, calm, as you advised. I couldn't calm down, the light gradually shrank and disappeared. I think it was inevitable because my handwriting was not being this good since primary school. Quite true, because when you get very still and concentrated, it's amazing. Everything gets very smooth and you can do nice things. Was it a limiter? Almost 99% certainty. That's what happens. Especially when your heart starts racing and you get excited. That's common cause for a limiter. But you did the right thing. Calm down. But you didn't calm down enough. So the limiter disappeared. When it disappears, should I come out of meditation or try to stay there and maybe go from there? Yeah, just stay still. You've just had a nice meditation. There might be a chance it may come back again. If you're very calm, don't expect anything and just relax. So stay there for a while. How do I calm down? Thank you for your compassion and kindness. Just always say, calm down! Okay? Calm! Calm! No, that's not the way you calm down. Loving kindness. It's a beautiful way to calm down. The door of my heart is open to me. Open to you, Nimitta, as well. If you want to come, fine. If you want to go, fine. So that beautiful loving kindness is one of the best ways to calm down. I heard that Buddhism treats men and women differently. Yes, it's very true. Even in monasteries, we have different toilets. You're treated differently, okay? Fair enough. And you'll notice here, the girl's toilet is closest. You see, so we treat you differently. Men are disadvantaged. It's true, we're disadvantaged. Please comment, if men are treated as superior, doesn't this create a gender gap? How is this consistent with Buddhist teachings? They're not. Look, precepts. Why do I sit up here and you sit down there? Because you only keep 8 precepts, and I keep 227 precepts. That's why you're higher. How many precepts does a bhikkhuni keep? They keep many more than I do, so they're superior. Think about that one. So, in some places they treat men and women differently. Original Buddhism, absolutely not. And here, we don't treat men and women differently. We're all treated exactly the same. Story for your roundedness. That's much better than roundness. Roundedness. That's very good. My grandma celebrated her 98th birthday 2 weeks ago. Amazing. Grandma is old and she uses a wheelchair. And because she could not speak, she communicates by writing on her notepad. A lot of my uncles, aunties, cousins came to her party. After a while, we noticed Grandma started leaning. No, I know this one. It's very funny though. After a while, we noticed Grandma starting leaning to the left. She's in a wheelchair. So quickly, my relatives stuffed a pillow on her left side to prop her up. Later, she started leaning to the right. And again, a few relatives noticed and stuffed a cushion on her right side. Then she started leaning forward, and my cousin sat her back and lightly tied her back to the chair. A bit concerned about Grandma, we asked her, "Are you okay, Grandma?" And she took out her notepad and wrote in capital letters, "These people won't let me fart." Okay. Okay, we've got lots of fart jokes in here now. Dear Ajahn Wang, this is very high dhammas, very profound this evening. When in the present moment awareness I noticed my breath and followed it until a thought interrupted, I then went back to present moment awareness. It gives variety for me. Is this okay? Yeah, that's very good. So you can go present moment awareness and breath, and then go back to present moment. That's fine. Give it a little bit of variety, and it works. Please advise how to purify negative karma. You don't purify, you just let it go. Imagine you're carrying all this rotten stuff with you. Just let it go. If that doesn't work, every retreat I tell this story. If you want to let go of all your negative stuff you've done in the past, every psychologist knows that the best thing to do, first of all, is write it down. Bring it up to the surface. So here, you can write it down on the best possible piece of paper, which is a roll of toilet paper. And if you can get brown ink, that's the best. So get out the toilet paper and write down all the rotten things you've done and people have done to you on a big roll of toilet. It's very long, it's very cheap, so you can write down everything on it. And once you've written it down, because it's on toilet paper and on brown ink, there is a psychology association with the other brown stuff which goes on toilet paper. And so once you've written it down, then you read it to yourself one more time to strengthen the association that this is shit stuff. And then, so what do you do? Then you do the letting go ceremony. You take it to toilet. And you put it in the bowl. And you press the button to do the letting go ceremony. Whoosh! And it goes round the bend, you don't see it again. Now actually, I invented that and said it at a psychology conference in Sydney. And as soon as I finished, and all the psychologists were writing it down. And it works. Because sometimes if I just say let go, it doesn't work. You've got to do something. That's why we have ceremonies. That's why we have marriage ceremonies and death ceremonies and ordination ceremonies. So it's just ceremonies, that's all. But you know, it emphasizes and reinforces the fact that two people are committing together. It makes the rite of passage to let someone go into death, be cremated. It makes that work. So the same with the letting go ceremony. Piece of paper, toilet paper, write it down. Read it. Make the association. This is not something you keep. How many of you, even if you belong to Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, so into recycling, how many of you, if you use one side of the toilet paper, turn it around and use the other side? You're wasting half of the sheet! You don't put it in your pocket and keep it for next time because it's only half used. As soon as it's got a small bit of brown on it, you throw it away. As you should do. So that association with what goes on toilet paper, it was really helpful. Write it down on toilet paper and then read it, and it's obvious what needs to be done next. And when you actually put it in the bowl and you press the button, it's as if you're letting go of the real things, the real memories. That's one great way of letting go of the past. In your new book, is your new book, Good, Bad, Who Knows, available for all at this retreat? No, it's not. You all come from Singapore. It's all over there. You know, I carried 60 kilos of them over here. Really, really heavy. And now you want to get them so that we have to bring more over here. And you have to carry them back to Singapore. They're available over in Singapore. So you get them from the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, because there'll be lots and lots and lots and lots of people want them over here. So I prefer to keep them for the people over here. And you've heard all the stories and jokes before. Dear Bhante, my understanding of the range retreat is monks have to stay in the monastery, but I noticed some monks travel. You were in KL. I've been busted. You're allowed 7 days. That's called the 7 day allowance to leave the temple for 7 days. We'll be back within 7 days. If it is important. And that was actually raising funds for the nuns of monastery. That was important enough to do. So you don't go there just to have fun. You know, when I go there, it's to work hard. So you don't go on a holiday. So 7 days is just to do something if it's really, really important. And if it's a range retreat, I have to ask all the monks, say, do you think this is important enough for me to leave for 7 days? So I had to do that. Ajahn, is jhana an enlightened state of mind? No, but it's close. You seem to suggest that. No. You mentioned about the not-so-clever monk who had to go to his past life to learn his chanting. What is your views on regression? Regression? We gave a talk on that over at, a couple of days ago. And that's... How many of you were at that talk with Peter Mack? Oh, okay, so most of you. So... It's true that if any of you are interested in regression, our ex-president over here, Dennis Shepherd, does it. And he just recently told me, I told a story that night, but it's a great story. It's one of the regulars who comes Friday nights to Nolamara Temple. And he didn't tell me why he wanted to be regressed, but Dennis regressed him. And you know, he really got deep very quickly. And he recalled his past life. He was an English soldier who came to Perth, this city, in about 1850. And once he finished his military commitments, he worked in Fremantle Jail for 1 year. And afterwards, he got a grant of land in the south, just north of Albany, in the south of Western Australia. He built his own house out of stone. got married, had a couple of kids, and he lived until 78 years of age. And it was such a very clear memory of his past life, with all the details which Dennis wrote down, and because it was not that long ago, they decided to go and check it in the records. 100% accurate. That name, that place, the house that exists down south, because there are not that many old houses, it's heritage listed. No one could actually destroy it. And he hasn't been down there yet, but he says in the, well, maybe about now, about one, well, if not now, in the next week or two, he's supposed to make an arrangement to go and visit his old house. And also, fascinatingly, they located his old grave. So he's going to go and visit his own grave, which is weird. See, that's where I'm buried. Because all those things still exist, and they're there on the records, it exists. The exact name, exact time. And the interesting part of that was, before he came to our Buddhist society, his job was a soldier with the Australian Army. And he said, that's what I did my last life. And when he joined our Buddhist society, he volunteered to do prison visits, because that's what he did last time. And he said, it's just like my life is just recurring again. The same sort of inclinations and character is coming back. So it's fascinating. That's what happens. So regressions, yeah, that's very true. Next question. Dear Bhante, I saw this cloud-like image. It changes colours. It shows different form that I've never seen before. It is so absorbing, I can't turn my focus away from it. I was aware of noises and my breathing fades into a smooth wave-like rhythm in the background. When I opened my eyes and checked my watch, I was in it for at least 1 hour. Please comment. Yeah, nimitta. Great. 1 whole hour. Brilliant. Carry on. So that it works. You see, so all of those teachings which I'm saying to you, see, they work, they're right. Very good. So, it was only a cloud-like image, so it wasn't a very strong, but it still works, so well done. Dear Ajahn, do we need to eradicate greed, hatred and delusion before we can reach a certain stage of stillness? And if one reaches certain stages of jhanas, do they still have the three roots? Greed, hatred and delusion existing? You have to suppress, you know, just limit them, calm them down, a lot of greed, hatred and delusion to get into the jhanas. And because they are calmed down or suppressed, it means you can actually see the truth very clearly. But it doesn't eradicate them, but it does give you the opportunity to eradicate them. You need more than jhanas. It's like the simile of someone with some gunpowder. But they still can't make anything, destroy anything. They can't destroy greed, hate and delusion. It's only gunpowder. They need a match as well. A light. And in that simile, the light is the jhanas. And actually that's one of the meanings. It's a play on words, because jhana also means to burn. From jayati. So you need the jhanas as the match, the light, and the gunpowder is the teachings of the Buddha, or the Dharma, which you've learned. When those two come together, something explodes. If you have only the teachings of the Buddha, you've learned everything, you've studied, you're a doctor of goodness knows what else, and you know all the Dharma, but you don't have the jhanas, you've just got the stick of dynamite, but nothing to light it. If you just got the jhanas, you know, the match, but no gunpowder, no teachings of the Buddha, again, nothing explodes. You put those two together and your defilements get destroyed. Can I say that whatever problems we bring to this retreat, failed marriages, no boyfriend or girlfriend, children who don't do well, career problems, lost a job, are depressed, got cancer, have to deal with pain, loneliness, fear, worry, stress? You're in a mess. No, you're not. You're fine. Letting go is a fundamental solution to all of them. Exactly. This is life. You know, We all have problems, failed marriages, no boyfriend or girlfriend. I've got no boyfriend or girlfriend. You may have children who don't do well. I've got disciples who don't do well. My career problem is I haven't got a retirement plan. I just keep on working forever. Lost a job. Now I've got too many jobs. I wish I could lose a few. Are depressed. Yeah, I'm really depressed. Have to deal with pain, loneliness, fear away. Now, letting go is the solution to everything. Let go of the past. Because it doesn't matter right now. You don't need a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You know, marriage is when you come to a temple, you're free. You're just here. Enjoy this moment. Just with friends. You know, you are family now. So you don't have to deal with anything. So here you can just be in this moment and you find a lot of the pain of life disappears. You mentioned in your previous talk that when you achieve a certain level of meditation, one needs guidance so as not to go in the wrong direction. Could you please elaborate on that? And how does one get such guidance back in Club Med Perth? Which is, I mean, it must mean Club Med Singapore or something. You get it from internet. There's so many talks, there's over 1,000 of my talks on the internet, on YouTube and goodness knows what else. And we worked out that I think I've already, there's more talks of me on the internet than there are suttas from the Buddha. I've worked really hard and they're all recorded. So there's plenty of information for you. You don't need more instructions, you just need more inspiration and encouragement to sit down and practice them. That's what you're here for. So you have enough guidance, it's already there. So you won't go in the wrong direction now. There are times when I enter a... So if you have any problems, just get on the internet, read the books. That's actually one of the reasons why I wrote Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, otherwise known as Happiness Through Meditation. It's actually like a workshop manual, so all the answers are there for you. There are times when I enter a calm, peaceful state, but suddenly a heavy, dark, sinking feeling arises seemingly out of nowhere. It lasts maybe a minute, then passes away, but the peace has also passed away. Oh, this is par for the course in meditation. Now this is a dark, sinking feeling. Just sink right into it. See how dark it can become. It really depends, because sometimes dark is just the way we perceive things disappearing. It's the absence of light, which is a good thing. It's things vanishing. So if you can understand what it means and go with it, it's actually delightful. And sinking means you're going inside of something, which is also a very, very good perception. So I think you enter the calm, peaceful state and that heavy, dark, sinking feeling arises. I don't think you've made good use of it, which is why the peace disappeared. So next time, just go with it and see just where you sink to. Dear Ajahn, what do you find to be the main difference between the retreatants at different countries? Nothing, really. You're, because when I come here, there's Singaporeans. When I go to Malaysia, there's Singaporeans. When I go to Penang, there's Singaporeans. That's why there's no difference. They're all the same country. Or Malaysians or whatever. No, they're just all pretty much the same. No difference. Just human beings, that's all. I hesitate to write. Oh, this is good. I hesitate to write such a brazen and dubious question. I like brazen questions. But maybe there are some poor fools in the audience who are in a similar predicament and can benefit from the response. I'm spending way too much time thinking about some stupid guy, I'm a girl, that quite possibly doesn't even like or respect me much. If it was even a stable relationship, that would be something, but this is the pinnacle of ridiculousness. The shut-up brain request doesn't seem to work. If I actually meet him again, I'll be so embarrassed that I was thinking of him, I'd want to run. But my biggest concern is I'm wasting so much precious time. Help! My chance of peace is being swept away like a sleeping village. It's just girls being girls, boys being boys. So, one of the things is that when you have the time like this, if you get a little bit bored, you tend to fantasize. And in the fantasy, you are always the hero. Because it's a fantasy, you can actually control it. You can make that boy the most amazing, beautiful boy. That's not what he's really like, but in the fantasy you can change things and alter like Photoshop. And you can make the scenario really romantic, so in the end, you come together. Oh. But you find fantasies like Hollywood movies, they always finish off at the happy time, just when they meet together and they ride off into the sunset. They never tell you what happens after they ride off. Real life. So remember, don't be too romantic, be real. Romance is nice, everybody likes romance, and it's, you know, it's a happy fantasy, but what it does, it doesn't really get you in touch with real life. And so a lot of people have romantic fantasies when they actually do find a partner and get married. You are not like in my fantasy, darling. Of course not, this is a real world we live in. Which means you have unrealistic expectations of relationships and your partner. And you've all been through that. But eventually, when you get real, people are people, boys are boys, girls are girls. When you get real and you understand, well, then you can still make a pretty good relationship out of it when you become realistic. The boy is not just going to be the boy of your dreams. And the girl is not going to be the girl of your nightmares. She's just going to be a boy, just being a girl. So, fantasy, don't get into that, and romance. Get real. And then, please, if you're a young person, don't ever get embarrassed if you find someone and you want to talk to them and go out with them. I say this to young people. When I first started going out with girls, of course I was embarrassed. You see a nice girl, you want to go up and talk to her, and you sort of mince up your words because you were too, nervous. And then I heard this great story, and that actually stopped all that nervousness. And this story was that when you're in your teens, early 20s, you are so concerned what other people think of you. Which is why, as girls you have to dress really, really hot. You have to, because, you've got to dress up for people. If you're a boy, you've got to actually speak, in a really like a macho way, or do macho things. And that's just because boys only do that because they're afraid what other people will think of them if they were themselves. And then they say, this is in your time of life, you're really concerned what other people think of you. Later on in life, in your 40s, you get what's called self-confidence. You can see how people dress in their 40s. They don't care. They're just going to dress comfortably. Who cares what other people think of me? So in your 40s, you don't care what other people think of you. And in your 60s, you finally discover, after all that time, people weren't thinking about you anyway. They're all thinking about themselves. And that was just a wonderful thing. So I can go up and, before I was a monk, go up and see a pretty girl to ask her out or something. And I knew she wasn't thinking about me. She was thinking about herself. Oh, how am I going to come across? Does he like me? Is my hair okay? So, realizing she wasn't thinking of me, I can do whatever I like. So please, the boy which you're fantasizing about, when you go up and see him, you don't have to worry, he's not thinking about you. He's thinking about, oh, she's coming up to me, what should I say? So that makes you really relaxed. So those are a few words. But when you're on retreat, forget about boys. They're just too much suffering, too much pain. Take my word for it, I'm one of them. And girls as well, just too much pain. You're free. It's so wonderful. You don't have to worry about boys and girls. So it's so wonderful. So just don't waste the time thinking about those things. You mentioned a need for fundraising for Bodhinyana and Jhana Grove. Could you start about the plans and how we could support? Nah. Because monks spend too much time asking for money, and I've been just doing so many fundraisers. So I'm making it difficult for you to support. For a change, isn't that nice? What is the name of those squawky grey crested cockatoos that live in the forest? The grey crested, now the ones you see in the forest, they're the red tailed cockatoos. You know, see the beautiful red tails? There's quite a few of them over here. They are a very endangered species. So it's great they're staying here. There's only a few of them left. So they're very beautiful. People say they squawk and the sound is not very nice, but I love that sound because it's the sound of the Australian forest. And they're the red-tail cockatoos. During meditation, can we contemplate on the Dharma, such as how fortunate we are to be here, practice the path of Dharma, especially in this current, previous, precious human life? Once I contemplate on it, it makes me feel more peaceful, happy. Yeah, you can do that. But don't spend all the time contemplating it. Because contemplating the Dhamma, Ajahn Chah said, that is like the dessert after your meal. Oops, sorry, I talked about food again. Sorry. So make sure you have the main course, first of all, which is the practice, meditation, and then you can contemplate. Your rounded holiness. That's very good. While we are, what's a round thing with a hole? Your wheel with another. Okay, your rounded holiness. While we are doing walking meditation, is it all right to let the mind reflect on the Dhamma? It's an amazing thing when I answer these questions, how many times I get two questions exactly the same and they come up together. All the ghost questions came up earlier, and now is it alright to let the mind reflect on the Dhamma? Come up okay. Make the mind peaceful first of all, and then you can reflect upon the Dhamma as the dessert. If all you eat is dessert, you're going to get diabetes. So, yeah, it's okay to have dessert once you've had the main course. Help! I feel like I'm invisible even before mastering the art of disappearing. Brilliant. Who said that? I can't see this. Does a silent retreat mean we don't acknowledge each other's existence? It often feels that way. No, you can smile. Smile at each other. That's all you need. That's the best form of communication, a smile. As soon as you open your mouth and say something, you always get in trouble. At least I do. Please encourage us to smile at each other. Yes. Please smile at each other. When loved ones are in pain, how can I help? I sometimes don't react. Because I remember once, I was walking on arms round in Thailand, and you know, you don't wear shoes, and I stepped on a nail, and it went about 2 inches into my foot. A rusty old nail. It didn't hurt. I looked at it, oh, that's interesting. And the monk with me said, oh no! And as soon as he said that, it hurt like hell. So please, don't do that. Someone said, oh, that was terrible. Oh, that's gross. Because that makes you feel much worse. So it's when if you see someone in pain, just laugh. You know, except what? There's one of the disciples here. She'd always been very healthy in her life, but eventually, she got to her age about 40, she had to have a hysterectomy. And if any of you girls have had a hysterectomy, you know how painful that is. Because they have to, or maybe these days they do it with keyhole surgery, but in those days, had a big gash, you know, on her stomach. But you know, it was the first operation, so she really needed some spiritual help. She was afraid. So she asked me to come and see her. So I went to go and see her in the hospital. And as soon as I went into the water, he said, "Ajahn Brong, please, no jokes, no funny stories." It hurts to laugh. But I can't change my nature. So I started laughing, and she started laughing. It hurts. Stop it. Get out of here. So it's okay to tell funny stories, but not when a person's had an operation like that, please. So that's one of the nice things about when someone's in pain. Because a lot of times there's two parts to pain. There's the physical part, and there's the mental part, which is, "I don't want this, it hurts, how long am I going to take this for?" So if you can, you know, make sure you discourage the mental part of the pain, you know, by not saying, "Oh, that's terrible, oh, you must really hurt, oh, I'm glad I'm not taking that operation." Don't be stupid like that, because it's the mental part, the fear, that is 99% of pain. So having a bit of a fun, bit of a joke, then you find that actually relieves the pain. It relieves the mental part of it, and the physical part is not that hard to deal with. Or you can try what Ajahn Chah did to me, you know that story, when I was so sick, thinking I was dying of typhus fever, with that nurse stabbing me twice a day, which I mentioned that earlier on in this retreat. That, he came up and said, the beautiful advice, loving advice from a master to his disciple, sitting there feeling so terrible, just wanting a bit of support. And what he said, "Brahma Wangso, yes, master? You'll either get better or you'll die." So if your grandma is in hospital, and you go and visit, come on, say, "Grandma, you can either get better or you die." And then you can go home. How many rows do you have? "I have three. One underneath, one on top, and a spare." "Do you change your robes daily?" "Yeah, I take my robes off every time I go in the shower." "Does wearing a robe make you feel like a Scotsman in a kilt?" "Sure." "I've never been a Scotsman in a kilt, so I don't know." "I do know, though, that because I travel a lot, and sometimes some countries are just so unhelpful that the toilets, they have the name in their local language. You know, like in Malaysia, you know, just, oh, in Indonesia, Panita is woman. I forget what the man was. Yeah, whatever it is. I don't know these names. So I just look at the picture on the outside and look at me and end up going in the wrong cubicle. That's what I look like. So that must be monks. I have just found your analogy of center focus and edges useful. Great. Now I sweep gently any stray thoughts to the edges where they can recede. Thank you. Yes, another satisfied customer. How to handle and manage the feelings of listlessness and anxiousness. If you're listless, it means no place you can find any rest. Remember that simile of the old stone bench, lumpy, cold, hard. It doesn't matter where you are, just sit down on it. And if you stay for a few minutes, all the listlessness disappears. The bench gets soft and warm and comfortable. So the listlessness is always just, you know, just like the donkey trying to catch the durian. Wherever you go, the happiness, whatever you're searching for, is always 2 feet away from you. You never catch it. And you can be listless throughout your whole life, going from job to job, to job, relationship to relationship, religion to religion, place to place. And there comes a time, you say, "Oh no, this is good enough." You stop. When you stop, that's when the durian comes to you. And anxious. What do you be worried about? We're all going to die. No anxiety at all. Who cares? "I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure." Then there's no anxiety anymore. Why do you have to worry about your husbands and past relationships and kids? You're going to die. Ha ha ha.
Bye-bye.
Some people, it makes them more anxious. So all anxiety, so what have you got to lose? Ask yourself, what have I got to lose? And if I lose it, then what? Are you anxious of losing your job? Then you can become a nun. So, good, bad, who knows, is a great way of overcoming anxiety. So if you haven't got that story, you should know it, because it's the first story in my new book. Can you teach a layperson to see his past life through meditation? Yeah, what you do, you have to get a deep meditation first of all. And when you get a deep meditation, you ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? And if your mind is ready, a memory will just pop up straight away. If his mind is not ready, it doesn't happen. Maybe I'll go on to that later on when I go into the deep meditations. Please advise the ways to make a confession to purify negative karma so as to remove the obstacles on the path of Dharma. Confess it on a piece of toilet paper. Those have already. Dear Ajahn, I find that when I let go, really let go, there is often a kindness, sometimes love towards others. And this kindness feels a bit different from the kindness and compassion you do as a practice. It feels more spontaneous and springs from the very space of letting go. Very good. I can't really pin it down in words. Can you elaborate more on this with thanks? Because most of the time when we are doing kindness, we're doing it. It comes from a sense of ego and self, something we construct. It's really quite fake. It's not far off, but it's not the real thing. That's why there's too many people. People say this about Buddhists. We chant the Metta Sutta. We just emphasize compassion, but we never practice it. And sometimes we don't really know it. It's just for us, it's a chant, it's words, but it's not our acts. It doesn't come from in our heart. It comes too much from our head. So as we do letting go, open the door of your heart to whatever is out there. And all the energy which you usually spend on fixing up yourself, from a sense of self, now can be free to help others. So it's very true, the more selfless you are, the more kindness you have for others. So it's of having a self, and that's what one is really letting go of. You're letting go of me and mine. Some people sometimes ask me, when you become fully enlightened, you've let go of craving. So what motivates an enlightened person anymore? What runs and drives an enlightened person is just kindness, compassion. That's the only thing left which keeps them alive and keeps them engaged with life. Lastly, what is ultimate reality? So now I'm going to tell you what ultimate reality is. There is nothing. That's what Ajahn Chah told me. Brilliant. That is the ultimate. Nothing left. That's why I mentioned earlier on this retreat, a Christian trying to convert me said, nothing is better than God. And I said, yes, you are right. Nothing is far superior. The great void. There is nothing. That's greatest teaching. That is the ultimate reality. There is nothing. What a great way. And you can just know this. Just contemplate your tummy. There's nothing in it. If ever you really want to understand emptiness. Just on an 8% retreat, contemplate your tummy. You've got emptiness. Nothing there. Great. And that's the ultimate reality. I'm hungry. Okay, enough for this evening. So thank you all for listening. And have a good night's sleep. Don't be afraid of ghosts. This place is protected. No ghost can come into this premises without my permission. And they haven't got any permission. So this place is ghost free. So you're safe. Totally, 100%. And you also have a nice night And don't worry about your tummy, there's lots of food in the tomorrow morning. So the more that you are empty in the evening, the more you appreciate the breakfast in the morning. So it makes it taste more delicious. So anyway, have a nice night. Let's see what happens later on. Not yet, no bows yet. We've got to do the three sadhus. Not yet, wait for it. Not too fast. There we go. Sadhu. 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 Thank you so much. See you in the morning.